Bill Simmons hosts the most downloaded sports podcast of all time, with a rotating crew of celebrities, athletes, media staples, and a slew of other friends and family members who always happen to be available. Check out the Bill Simmons podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
Cool. Remember those voice videos of what I used to have of Lola saying, "Are you talking to me?" Have you got those?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, could you find them and send them to Roscoe, please? Just gonna I might play on the podcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Writer's House on Ringer FC. Hope you're all safe and well. We're not going to talk much about football today, to be honest. I was trending twice this week. So we'll talk about that. Also talk about watching Sean and Bradley. Nerve-wracking business, that is, as a parent. And then we're going to talk a bit about Pele, the Pele documentary. And my guest today is Mr. Ryan Hun, a.k.a. Ryan Hundieta. How do we say that one, right? What is the one we say?
Raiska Hundieta.
Hundieta. Give me another one. There's another one.
Ilrai Hunduan was your favorite.
That's my favorite. Ilrai Hunduan. You okay, my friend?
I am all right. Thanks. How are you?
So this morning, Rai. Mm-mm. If I'm going to be totally honest, you know what I mean? But I feel good because there's a lot of good things happening at the minute. But obviously, Rai, yesterday and everything that happened, Harry, Meghan, and all the stuff that was going on, right? It's intriguing and unbelievable television to watch, but obviously, you know, the Oprah meme is horrible to see. I think that everybody who knows me and know what I'm about, I own that, bro. Mm-hmm. I own that. You come for me, no yeah. problem. And you've seen, and everybody's seen, I'll own that, I'll share that, I'll do that. But for them to be using someone like Oprah with everything what's going on, you know, the stereotypes, you know, what happens with black women and, you know, what black women are seen, dark-skinned black women as well. And I got an unbelievable email today from a lady called Sadie, and it nearly made me cry simply because she said she was on Twitter and that literally for 12 hours trying to explain to people and educate people about why that is wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, a black woman, a dark black-skinned woman being like, you know what I mean, saying that she looks like a man and using me in it. And when people who went on there and rightly went on there trying to put the argument forward why it's wrong to be doing that and then just being called snowflake, it's sad, right? Simply because it makes my stomach feel really weird because you simply can't get to people. On International Women's Day, you know, and we're talking about, you know, interview with Meghan and Harry, some unbelievable stuff in that interview. Mm. And what a lot of people took from that is Oprah Winfrey looking like me and that. And I just felt really, I got a message from somebody who's majorly high profile. And, you know, I just had to send something back saying, boy, that's one of the great ones, man. You know, what they're doing to black women there. You don't know what happens to black women online, black women in dating apps, how they're ridiculed and the amount of abuse they get for how they look. And You know, I had to just blast that back in the WhatsApp because whatever happens, and like Sadie says, she spent like 12 hours trying to explain to people why it's wrong, you know? Mm. You know, I've had messages from everybody about it. And, you know, it's only when people believe that these things are funny and you try to let them know. It's not funny, man. It's their way of belittling Oprah in a way that seems socially acceptable that they can pass off as banter. It's not fucking banter, right?
No.
It's not good, bro. So it was one of those kind of nights because I was doing the football till late and someone said, right, you're trending. I thought, fuck, man, what have I said? I said something. I know I haven't said anything. Am I looking too miserable? but like, you know, you look at it and I remember I sent it to Roscoe because I got it from somebody. And Roscoe said, we're not fucking getting involved in this fuckery, bro. This is wrong, man.
I did the same thing. I logged into Twitter, saw you were trending last night, and I was chatting to Musa about it.
Mm. What's Musa saying?
Musa was just like, it was fucking grim. That was his exact words. Yeah, and that was the exact... to be honest, you know, obviously just the usual caveat at the top of this, like, you know, I'm a straight white dude. My opinion on this when I saw it was that it just made me feel a little... Well, not a little bit, quite a lot sick.
Mm.
And there's a reason for this because the undertones on it were multiple and very, very bleak. It also dove into like deep stereotypes.
Yeah.
All black people look the same.
Mm-hmm.
Black people are indistinguishable from each other. And my opinion on this is that if you want to pass it off as lighthearted banter, and I saw a lot of people that were just like, oh, come on, it's just a joke. Like, here's one of Ellen DeGeneres and Owen Wilson. Yeah, and it's like, yeah, but think about it for a second. Is your meme for some retweets and likes and a little bit of banter worth digging up years and years and years of trauma for black people and black women specifically? Is it worth it?
Mm.
Is your little joke worth it? Really? Whether you mean any harm by it or not, or whether you think it's quite lighthearted or not, is it worth it?
Right. It goes back to the simplicity of it. Your nan, somebody putting something like that about your mum, your sister, your nan, you know, I remember that the guy who actually put it on there, that's the kind of, I think I read the tweet because I don't really read them, but you know, when you just fucking can't stop picking that scab that's not ready.
Yeah.
But you know, and I looked at it and he said, and he kind of like added me in and said, come on, righty, you've got to find this funny. And I thought to myself, Jesus Christ, bro, you are so missing the point here for me to find that funny. So missing the point. Because I know what black women go through on a daily basis. And like I say, with Sadie, with the email she wrote, I can't imagine the emotional stress that would have cost her, that would have caused her simply trying to explain on Twitter. She should have saved herself. I'm glad she got in touch simply because, you know, people need to know. What is tough is when you're trying to explain it and they do the snowflake calling me woke, which I still think that they've got that wrong. When you're woke, it's because you know you're awake.
Yeah, but also this is again like a white hijacking of a black term.
Mm.
This takes work. Even the smallest bit of work, i.e. this tweet could be quite mean, actually.
Yeah.
And my experience as a straight white guy on the internet in football is vastly different from yours as a black man in football. It's vastly different from anyone in the LGBTQ community. Mm. Black women are subjected to some of the most awful stuff on social media. Am I ever going to know what that feels like? No. Mm. But like, is it going to cost me anything as a straight white guy? And I'm kind of speaking for straight white guys in general, hopefully here. Like, is it going to cost me anything if I don't post a meme comparing two black people in terms of likeness? Is it going to cost me anything to not post that? No. Will it cause harm and cost a huge demographic of people if I post that meme? Yes. Then what's the fucking point?
No, right. The thing is, right, because you don't want to be, because on this podcast, which I love, and I have to say at this point as well, the messages and the support and everything that you get on here is so constructive, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's fucking refreshing. It's so good. And that is why I feel like I can come on and, you know, let people know that my fucking, my heart has got tears, just, you know, just rolling down. You know that cry when you was younger where, you know, I mean, I done it many times when I was a child, you know, the cry where I'm just sad for my situation. And I'm thinking that the whole world was against me when I was younger because everything was going on and tears just rolled down your face. That's how my heart feels this morning. But in respects of trying to let people understand, so don't say, you know, it's banter. Oh, come on, right? It's banter. I just want people to understand why that wasn't funny. That's, I just want the guy who sent it to me last night, my friend, to understand why I just sent back, listen, man, that's one of the great ones, bro. You know, absolutely dissing one of the greats. Come for me. Blast me. Just do what you want. And, you know, leave Oprah out of it, man. Leave her out. But you know what, right? Just to close it off, one of the things that I could not stop thinking about more than anything else was, if they can come for Oprah like that, then what are everyday black women going through? And this is why I say, with Sadie, is saying she was trying to put people right. What are those people going through? Those dark-skinned black women who have to deal with that kind of just like abuses.
Yeah.
All the time. And that is why, you know, I have to say what I've said. And I'm quite pleased that it's here because I know that people will understand. And if you don't understand, it's not a problem. There's many podcasts you could go to get your banter fix and this and that. Oh, I didn't come for that. Don't, if you're going to come to Righty's House, and I feel I could speak for Stadio and hear it coming from a place of pure love and passion, this ain't the place for you. It's not the place for you. So that's all I would say in that respect, right? But let me just move on now, right? Simply to the Lacazette, man.
I was going to say, because this weren't the first time you've been trending in the last couple of days, right?
You know, and the main thing here, right, is I got that wrong. I got that wrong. And it's only the screaming at the end. But the reason why I've been okay with it, and, you know, me and Roscoe spoke about it, and the fact is, right, is that it's always, screaming has always been a problem for me with the guys. Now we can hear it. And we're talking about massive screams to the point where you're thinking, oh my God, something's wrong with this player. This week, it just happened to be Lacazette, right? And like I say, I got that wrong. But what I did, when you see all the shit that comes back, and, you know, in hindsight, of course the shit's going to come back, especially that the fact that it was an Arsenal player and it's me and Laka go back and we've got correspondence. I got in touch with him on Sunday morning so as we could clear it up and let him know. I explained that this is not a direct, the way it was portrayed on social media, the way it was, and it was Laka in that particular incident. It seems like it was digging out Laka. Bam, you are. But we were digging out screaming. Mm-hmm. My biggest mistake was screaming at the end. It was fucking stupid. And at the end of the day, no problem for Gary Lineker. Gary Lineker goes about his business. No problem for Dion Dublin. At the same time, I have to accept and realize what that means to Arsenal fan base, what that means to me, for them to feel like one of their own is supposedly digging him out. Now, I can only say I'm digging out screaming. I'm digging out screaming. We're talking about people who are screaming and they get up and they play on. If he stayed down or if a player stays down, like let's talk about like Raul Jimenez. You know, we're talking about somebody who literally, where as we speak, we don't even know if he's going to play again.
Yep.
So I don't want to make it too much of a massive thing where I'm saying, but the screaming for me, from anyone, is not necessary. And what I said to the BBC now that we've doing that, because we've been speaking about it for weeks before, oh my God, the screaming, oh my God. In the office, everybody, as soon as there's a foul, everybody does the scream, right? You know, everybody does the scream, how loud it was. And I said to them, if there's no consistency, because what we saw was a lot of people mentioning Harry Kane, mentioning this one, mentioning that. If they're not going to do it with them, then I spoke to the BBC, I spoke to the boss, the main boss, spoke to him. I said, if that's not going to happen, then I'm compromised. And I can't afford for Lacazette and Arsenal fans and people to feel that I'm ridiculing a player. I'm ridiculing the screaming. Like I say, the main thing was making that right with Lacazette. I'm not bothered about what comes back in respect to people digging out, right? But I needed to make sure he was okay with that. And he was.
Yeah, I mean, because basically a lot of the stuff I saw about it was just people like, how dare you do that to Lacazette? You two are supposed to be like pals and stuff like that. So You hit up Laka.
Absolutely.
And he had just to. Said, what was the thing? He just said, he was just like, it's no thing, man. Don't worry about
it. It's nothing, man.
It's ain't a thing.
That's nothing. That's not a thing, bro.
Yeah, don't worry about it. Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, to the point where I said, and I'm glad you're okay as well. You know what I mean? The kind of joke. Yeah. You, and because sometimes what I see with social media is that they want this fucking round house fucking pylon, bro. They want it. They want, it's like they want to see what the fly looks like when you've pulled its wings off. They want to just watch that, bro. And it's really tiring.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to touch on something like that in a little bit, but I just wanted to say about the Laka thing first, because, like, you know, I'm an Arsenal fan. I grew up watching you play. Like, obviously, over the last, 8 months or so, we've started working together a little bit more. We met for the first time, like, 18 months ago.
At the Emirates.
At the Emirates, yeah. I've been through that whole cycle, and I don't mind saying this to your face, you know, it's because it's like, but you're a club legend at the club that I support and that I grew up supporting, that my dad spent some time at, as well as a never as a first team player, but as a player, you know. I know that with Stadio stuff, I have to be a lot more balanced, and I think I'm pretty balanced on there. You know, I can praise Spurs,
yeah.
But I wanted to say a few things as an Arsenal fan about this, because I was watching it thinking, like, okay, so if I didn't know Wrighty now, how would I view this? And I'd be like, well, first of all, like, not wanting to get into like Gary Neville getting out the Sky Pad on Monday Night Football for it. You can see here, Carragher, right? What he's done is he's hesitated slightly and then he's gone for it. And you can tell that you're not really feeling it, right? And that you've just, it's live TV and you've just been caught up in the moment a little bit. And that's it. It ain't that deep, basically.
Right.
And
people are not that calculated to think like that.
But the thing is also, I never say we or us when I'm talking about Arsenal and Stadio. I sometimes say it on Wrighty's house because usually when it's you, me and Jeanette, right?
Yes, it is us.
But I never do that on Stadio because I don't want it to be a partisan podcast. It's not an Arsenal podcast. And the same with, it's not a Manchester United podcast. And this is a Manchester United fan. But I was thinking, if I didn't know you and I was watching that, I was like, and this isn't necessarily a criticism of you. This is more of a criticism as a viewer of Match of the Day. I'd be like, yeah, it's a bit crap, but I can see where they've done it. At the end of the day, it's just a bit crap. But the pushback in terms of like, you're some actual club ambassador, I think frankly is a little bit bullshit because I can't think of anyone in the punditry world that's as pro Arsenal or the club that they played for as you are with Arsenal. It's always we, it's always us. It's always like when things are going well, you stray into fandom. And I think people love that. But what also people fail to understand is that you know Laka a hell of a lot better than anyone pushing back on that. It'd be like me taking the piss out of Musa on here and a load of people being like, I'm ashamed of you, Ryan. What the hell are you doing? How dare you dig Musa out like that? And I'm like, hang on a minute. You have no idea what mine and Musa's relationship is like. You have no idea. And you're also assuming that I am that much of a bad friend that I don't know where the line is.
Yeah.
And I think it goes on to something else at the moment that you and I were talking about on Sunday, actually, when we had that chat on the phone. And it's happened a couple of times with Stadio, and I don't want to make it about me or Musa, but I think that, like, it's something I talked about on Stadio on Monday with regards to Liverpool. And we mentioned it last week or the week before when we were talking about Josip Iličić from Atalanta about everyone's going through the pandemic. Your circumstances are vastly different from a number of people who might be watching Match of the Day or who don't have, you know, the kind of, I don't want to use this stuff, but like the wealth or the comfort that you have, right?
Right.
Which is a fair thing to say. But it doesn't mean that you're still not going through it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you're still not worried about your family or you've had to have your kids at home for a long period of time because they couldn't go to school or you can't see members of your family or you're worried about elderly members of your family or it's a small thing, but none of us have been able to get together since we started doing Wrighty's House. Yeah. We've never been able to do any of that. From my point of view, obviously, straight white dude on the internet, the kind of the least in terms of like being affected by hate, let's say.
Yeah.
In terms of a demographic. But I think because people hear Musa and I being quite cheerful and jovial on Stadio twice a week, everyone just assumes we're fine. I think everyone assumes that we're just skateboarding through it. But we're not. Like Musa and I, we've lived alone throughout the whole of the pandemic. We live in a different country to our family. I've lost a family member through COVID. My grandparents are getting to an age where not seeing them for well over a year is worrying me. This isn't a sub story, but what I'm saying is that just because you're a Match of the Day or ITV or any of that stuff, you're still dealing with the pandemic. I've noticed that Twitter has got a hell of a lot more charged during the pandemic because people are obviously stuck inside.
Sit around,
Clicks. But we always say on Stadio that we really hope everyone's staying safe and doing okay. Yeah. And we genuinely mean that. The only thing I would chuck in here in terms of advice is that just think a little bit before you tweet something, because just because you're Ian Wright or just because, you know, Musa is Musa and you have high profiles and high followings on Twitter, doesn't mean that you won't see it. There's a human being at the end of a message, and there's a human being at the end of a tweet. And in my weird fucking rambly way, what I'm trying to say is that the match of the day thing and the Oprah thing, I don't think are massively isolated. And it's all part of the same thing where just think about things before you tweet someone, because like I said with the Oprah meme, is it really fucking worth it?
I know. The thing is, right, I'd love that. But, you know, that's dreamland kind of thing to say to somebody to think about, because even like we mentioned, the guy who put it out there and at me in, the blatant disregard of everything what he's just done and just feeling like I'm just going to jump on. It's just, he's the arrogance of it. But what I would say with Arsenal fans and the Lacazette situation is they know me. That was a mistake. So to come with your 0 to 10 and you go straight to 10 because you see me doing that, you know, it just feels like, well, what about what I've got, about the credit in the bank? What about the fact that, you know, the BBC and like for years, like whether I'm on ITV or BBC, you know, with England, it's us. Mm-hmm. You know, with Arsenal, it's we and us. The amount of times I've been told, Ian, and the amount of times you're getting people saying, Ian, it's, you know, you're meant to have an unbiased opinion. I said, I've got an unbiased opinion, but I can't just naturally, when that comes in, I'm speaking about Arsenal, not say us. I'm not sure that people understand exactly what the club mean to me, but, you know, I'm not going to go deep into that again. Everybody who knows my story should know what it means to me, going way back early 80s with David Rocastle and how it all started to end up being there, doing what I did there and everything going like it did. I'm not going to stop saying we or us. So it's accepted by the BBC, to a certain extent, it's accepted by fans now. Because they will hear, I will speak about Arsenal, and if Arsenal need to be critiqued, I'll do that, and it's coming from a place of love. I'm not looking to lambast my club.
I'd never see you dig anywhere.
I won't do it. What I'm saying is that people know what I'm about, where it comes from. It comes from a pure place. I made a mistake with Lacazette and laughing at the end with Gary Lineker, and like I say, it doesn't really affect Gary Lineker or Dion Dublin like it affects me. Now, I'm probably going to have to hold that one, and I don't mind. The reason why I don't mind is because I've spoken to Laka.
And he's the only guy who matters.
That's the only person that matters. But it just disappoints me when I see Arsenal fans, and obviously there's an old new generations of Arsenal fans that didn't see me play. They don't really know the deepness of my attachment and my love. They just see me on the television. They see me talking about it. But the fact is that there's nothing I would do to try and besmirch Arsenal name, a player's name, and that. And my big mistake was that scream at the end. I made a mistake.
Can I jump in there, though?
I want to own that simply because if you don't own it, they just keep coming.
Yeah.
It's fine.
The two things I was going to say was, like, everyone makes mistakes all the time, and it's how you deal with those mistakes that is the most important thing, because no one's perfect. We're human. Like, we all fuck up, like, all the time. The second point I want to make is that in the grand fucking scheme of things, that of everything that's gone on this week, it's minor. It's minor, man. Like, honestly,
it doesn't feel minor, right? It doesn't feel minor.
I'm an Arsenal fan. I've been an Arsenal fan since I could walk, right? Before that, you know, my dad signed for the club when he was 12, played centre midfield in the youth team with Liam Brady. Like, no one can fuck around with my Arsenal fandom. Like, no one can do it. And they won't. I've had a thing this year where I've been like, I'm zen about Arsenal because if there's a pandemic going on, I just want them all to stay healthy and happy. You know what I mean? Because there are bigger things at play here. You reluctantly joining in with a jokey scream about players screaming at the end of match of the day, in the grand scheme of things, like, for the outrage, I would have loved to have seen people get that outraged about the Oprah meme, put it that way.
Wow, exactly. Exactly.
And I think perspective is needed here, because I'm lucky enough that we've got to know each other, right? So I knew that you'd be on the phone to Lacazette.
Yeah.
In the same way, that if a load of people came for me on Twitter for calling Musa a catfish, which he is, by the way, I would be like, well, first of all, like, when was the last time you spoke to Musa? Mm-hmm. Second of all, how many times have you had to sit in front of him and order and see him order another slice of cake when he's just had one? He's my pal and I love him and I would never do anything to hurt him. And you would never do that with Lacka.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But right, to be able to explain that when literally everyone, can we speak to Ian about this? Can we speak to Ian about this? No, I'll say it on here and it's done.
I'm going to say it in my house wearing a onesie.
In my yard to Ross Glart.
Before we move on the last episode of Stadio, I said that Celtic drew a Dundee on the weekend. And I want to apologise to all Dundee and Dundee United fans because obviously Celtic drew with Dundee United. I'm a silly boy. So, and I said I'd put it on the next podcast. So there you go. You're the only one who fucked up this week, right? Quick one before we go on.
Go on.
My dad messaged me the other day.
I love when your dad get involved. I love
it. Shouts to dad. I think dad is so invested in Wrighty's house now that he thinks he's part of the squad.
He's part of the squad.
So Saturday, Sean's on Soccer AM.
Right.
That's it.
Is that what you said?
And I just wrote, right, Phillips, question mark. And he just wrote, yep. That was just it. Like, haven't heard from him since.
I love that. It's just, Sean's on. So make sure you watch Sean.
Sean's on.
I love that.
I've never met Sean.
It's funny because I was really, because even now, just quickly, right?
Yeah.
Sean was on that. And you know, you have to, so you have to do a penalty. You have to do a volley. Mm-hmm. You have to take the keeper on 1-on-1 and you have to hit the crossbar. And he'd done all four. And it was like, I was so nervous. But like, then when he, I was always more nervous about Sean and Bradley when they played than ever myself.
Really?
Oh, it was fucking horrible, right? To the point where I stopped going to Chelsea. I had to stop going to Chelsea. The shit that he would get. And like, people know that you're in earshot.
Mm.
The fucking stuff that they used to say. So it's still, anytime he's got to perform or do anything, it makes me nervous.
Really?
Yeah, it makes me, I'm very nervous. It was something that I didn't realize. And you know, you think you're going to go and watch a game with your son. And honestly, what him and Bradley went through just to become professionals, Ryan, it's, you know, their journey was even tougher than mine, Sean's especially. So once they made it and got to there, you're thinking, oh my God, I'm so proud of that. Soon as you walk in there and you sit down, your stomach turns into mush.
Yeah, I bet.
Mush. You know, especially playing for England, it's even worse. You know, so I'm glad the way he blasted onto the scene, done well for himself, but constantly telling me about, you know, he's got a couple more caps, which is like, that kind of sits you down whenever you're talking.
Whatever. He's got a couple more caps than you?
He's got a couple more, yeah.
So no way.
He sits me down, man. Because I got 33. 33. I think Sean has got 36.
Sean, that is a flex.
It's a beautiful flex as well.
Why was that not on the Christmas Facebook ads? That should have been.
Because he hasn't got the same quickness in his banter as me. He's just realized he's just found that. But
hey, listen, don't, because you're going to have a load of people come after you on Twitter being like, how dare he go after Sean like that? How dare he go?
So when we go into it and then it gets to a side, but then it'll just go, get your caps on the table. That's like, you cheeky little bastard.
Sean, that is amazing.
Beautiful.
Does Sean listen to this?
I'm sure Sean listens.
Sean, you're amazing. On Sean quickly before we move on. I met him when I was a kid.
Seriously? Where'd you meet him?
When he was at City. They were training at my school playing fields one summer.
Wow.
I was really starstruck, man, when I met him because he was like exploding onto the scene and everyone was just like, Sean Wright Phillips, man. That's right, son. On the boys though, quickly before we move on. I mean, they've done all right, huh?
You know, the thing is, like I say, right, just as a parent, you're watching... just as a parent, and all you want is for them to do well. So from a young age, all I'd say to them, when I used to take them to football and watch from afar, is, you know, if you want to play at a high level, pass your teammates, do not give the ball away. Said to Bradley, hit the target. From a young age, I'd say to Bradley about hitting the target. And I think that that's something that you've got to tell strikers. You've got to make them know that it's muscle memory, that when they get anywhere near the goal, the first thing in their mind should be hitting the target. Mm. As you do that, what will happen is that you get more and more adept at knowing you're going to hit the target, then you can start being more precise. And that is what, that's why I like the beautiful finishes.
When we're allowed to be around people again.
Yeah.
You know, what I'd love to do on Wrighty's House is a round table of player parents talking about their kids playing.
Wow.
It's like you, Patrick, Claudio Reyna and Danielle Egan talking about Gio, and like Alfie talking about Erling and all
You know, the thing about things. It is that why that would be amazing is because I don't think anyone as a parent, and the fact is, it's even Robin Van Persie. I know that Robin Van Persie's son's really good, but hopefully he'll make it. But it's just getting that the professional advice from a young age when you see something. Because when Sean and Bradley were younger, especially Bradley, because Nottingham Forest only took Sean on the provided that they were getting Bradley.
Really?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
That's what, so they got Bradley, then they took Sean. Because when they released them, they both just went, Man City just went, we'll take you, bam.
Yeah.
Both of them got to the first team. But I remember continually telling them things like that. You touch, no. When you're receiving that, you have to make sure that you know where he is, where he's coming from, make a move, then go to receive it. So when you get it, if your touch is bad, which it shouldn't be, you've got time to maybe readjust yourself. So you're telling them stuff that is what professionals do when they're kids. So if they get it and they're good enough and they've got the ability, like all these people, like we're talking about, all the kids and that, they've obviously got the ability.
Mm.
You ingrain that from a young age, then they're already at a level that when they're playing, that other kids are not at. And that is why you can see where, wow, look, he's tough. You will very, very seldom, you know, you probably won't find a professional footballer who's got a son who's a professional that is not very well versed in the intricacies of playing their particular position.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned this quite a lot on the podcast, but even the level that my dad played at, and you could just tell, like, he was never a full professional.
Right.
But even when I went to watch him play when he was like 40 playing for Vets teams and stuff, and you know when you just like, you can tell people who have played at a certain level compared to people who haven't, you know?
Yeah.
And he used to always guide me through stuff like that. And even at the level that he played at, which was semi-pro basically. I mean, Arsenal 12 to 19, I think, played in combination, which was like the old equivalent of the under 23s basically now. Yeah. But even then, like people would like look, the stuff that I would get taught from him compared to a parent who had never been anywhere near a professional setup was wild. Like,
absolutely wild.
So if you like then magnify that by someone who is like a club like Arsenal's second highest record goal scorer. But I mean, the thing that I was going to ask you though was like, because I think a lot of people, they're obviously just, they always want to compare the parent to the child, right? As a parent in that scenario, you want them to be better, right? You want them to hit higher heights.
Yeah.
There's never any like, oh, actually, I did this, your dad did this. You want them to be
No. And the thing is, both of them, and I'm not just saying, when you look at technical ability, like Bradley's link-up play and play, I used to see Bradley playing when he was eight, nine and 10, in and around that age. Same with Sean, where they'd pop the ball off and move, pass the ball into somebody and make a move and go. And that's when, I remember one time saying to Mark Bright, after watching Sean and stuff, I said, a boy can play, bro.
I honestly think a lot of people have forgotten how good Sean was.
But the thing is with it, right, is that, you know, you say your boy can play, you have to be very careful because of the pressure that they will come under. So when I say, he's doing things. Same with Bradley. Bradley, when I was 12, when I watched them two, when they were both 12, at different stages, obviously, because Sean's older, Bradley would go link up the play and move, which I didn't have a fucking clue about when I was 12. Remember, I think I've said on this podcast about having to learn the game on the fly when I got to Palace, learning certain things. But then I passed that to them. So when they were 12 and that, I'd see them go link the play and move. Whereas me, Jesus Christ, I'd go get the ball, turn around. I literally cannot remember from the age of 9 to 12 passing to anyone else. Until you start playing at the district and you're watching people popping it off and that, then you see. But when you get into the professional game, you see what it's about. Your movement helps other people.
Mm.
What you do, your link up play helps somebody else.
Mm.
And that's what I learned, especially going to Arsenal.
Mm.
You have to make moves so other people can get space, because there's other people on the pitch just as good as you, some better, that they need to do their bit as well to help the team. It's not just like when I was younger, I have to get the ball, I have to beat everybody because I'm the quickest and I have to score the goals.
Yeah,
like I mentioned about learning, teaching the guys that from an early age, then obviously I've mentioned that I've had to learn it on the fly at Palace at 22. When I got to England and international level, it went to another level of movement, touch. You literally, you cannot get the movement wrong. You cannot get the touch wrong. Because when you lose the ball at international level, which is something that I was more petrified of than anything, you're not getting it back.
Sorry, was that Italy-England game in Rome, like when you were like, I've leveled up again?
That I leveled up. Leveled up because I know I'm playing against the best. I'm going into the game knowing that this is the weakest part of my game has to be the strongest on this particular day. Something that I always thought that I wasn't very good at. And I didn't realize, sometimes I watch games now and I say, blimey, that's good link up play. But it's something that going into games, I was absolutely petrified of getting my movement wrong to get the touch, to lay it off for other people to benefit. And when I played in that game, which for me, like I say, if I scored, it didn't hit the post, it would have easily have been the greatest performance I've put in a game, because not only was I literally on my own up front, Teddy Sheringham was behind me, but I was closing them all down. I worked hard, I ran, and it's to the point where when I got that chance where I hit the post, it was like nearly 90 minutes and I was still full of running, and I blasted past Ciro Ferrara, went past the goalkeeper, tried to cut it back, then hit the post and that. But the point I'm making is that the level you have to go to in respect of your runs and your touch was an education. And after that game, I felt like I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm actually here. I've done it. I'm on this level and I don't look out of place.
Yeah, and I mean, you didn't. I remember watching that game.
No, but right. But the thing is, you say that, but like the point I was making before, what I was trying to make was, I've never been so afraid in a whole week of playing football leading to a game. Never been that afraid before or since.
Mm.
Never been that afraid. And I'm just so pleased the way it went. You know, I'd love to watch that 90 minutes of football, knowing how I felt before I went into that game, then watching it. And then I've got a picture at my house of me at the end of the game, and I'm in the middle of the pitch, hands clenched, and I think I'm crying.
Mm.
I'm not sure. I think I'm crying, and I'm like this, right? And tears, I think, because in that moment, I realized that I'd done it, bro.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I think about it now, it makes me want to cry. I was crying. I remember when I was crying, and this is the thing what kind of takes you out of crying, because Robbie Fowler, Steve McMahon, when those guys, man, they're cool. The Scousers, they are so real. They're so real. And I remember I was down like this and I was crying. Robbie Fowler came over to pick me up to pick me up to say, well done. And when I turned around, I had the contorted face of emotion and crying face like this. And Robbie went, what the fuck's wrong with you? And you know what? It kind of made me think, yeah, let me just fix up myself. But
that is amazing.
It was honestly, it was like that. But he gave me a hug and said, yeah, well done, well played. Because what happened is on that night as well, centre forwards recognised the game I played that day.
Yeah. That was the, if there was like a secret club, you were kind of, I got the invite to get in.
But
like, I was on the phone to my old mate, Ruben. Shouts to Ruben Platt, good dude. And he was like, oh, I actually had a question. I was wondering, like, when you do a mailbag on Wrighty's house. And I was like, well, I'll just ask him this week. But he said, yeah, but I'm a bit worried it might like bum him out a bit.
No.
And he said, was there one chance you wish you could have back?
That
one, right?
Absolutely it.
Yeah.
You know, even when I watch it, you know, Ruben, it's a brilliant question, simply because you never get over that chance. What more could you have done? And sometimes I think to myself, should I have come out and try to hit it? But remember, we've got Cannavaro trying to get back, Maldini, all these lot trying to get back. And I've gone past the goalkeeper, running out of space, thinking, I know I haven't got time. I know I haven't got time to get it back and take more than a touch to try and hit it on target. Even when I watch it back, I think, I'm not sure what more I could have done. But if I could have, just for the satisfaction of the way I played in that game, to round it off with a goal. But like, when I look back at it, Rye, there's nothing about how it went for me that I can say, I wish this and I wish that. Yeah. I had it. I took full advantage of it.
The thing with Rome, though, is that there's part of me that's kind of glad it never went in.
Why?
Because there are very few positive misses that you can recall in football history.
Oh my God.
Do you know what I mean?
Know where you're going. I know where you're
going. Because the thing is, it was ultimately a really glorious night for England, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of those happy misses, like Pele versus Uruguay.
Oh my God. You know something? Again, it's the same as with my miss against Italy. Every time I see it, I think this is going to go in this time.
Mm.
But you know what was beautiful? It's just the body swerve. And then, you know, to try and hit it. I remember telling people about hitting the ball when you're falling over.
Mm.
And then when he missed it, there's three things that Pele have done. What didn't end up with a goal that were absolutely orgasmic to watch. One was, I think, I'm not sure if it was the same game where he tried to hit it from the halfway line, just before the halfway line, right? The other one was the goalkeeper
was that against Czechoslovakia?
Could have been, but it was the way, like Musa says, when you're a spectator on your own effort, and normally when the chip goes in, you're a spectator on your own goal. But what the whole world watching Pele try to hit one in from in his own half, and it just missed. And then there's another one where the goalkeeper tries to half volley out. It goes to Pele in and around the center circle, and he hits it first time.
Oh,
Ryan,
the goal kick.
And it literally zooms back. It stays maybe 3 feet maximum off the ground, all the way like an exit missile. And the goalkeeper saves it. And it's just like the way he hit it. He hit it side and it just like fucking flew. And then obviously the miss against Uruguay. But I watched the documentary, right?
Yeah, me too, yeah.
And once I watched that documentary and I knew how great, because even my mum knew about Pele. My mum was the first person who told me about the goalkeeper, Felix. My mum used to talk about the goalkeeper, Felix, right?
Wow.
And watching that World Cup, and it's my favorite World Cup apart from, I'd say, it will be my favorite World Cup apart from Maradona's, which I was watching, and it was just because I loved Maradona and that. But I think that 1970 was the best World Cup. But when you look at everything that led up to that, from 58 with Brazil, thinking they were going to win the first World Cup against Uruguay in 50, the pressure they were under in 58 against Sweden, and everything that Pele had to do from then to 1970, right? It was amazing.
I get very emotional with stuff like this. And I mean, the thing that I realized, when I was watching it, I was like, I wonder if Antonio Pinto did the soundtrack, because it was very similar to Senna.
Right.
And it was, same guy.
It was the same fellow, done
it. And I remember going to see Senna at the cinema, the Corner House in Manchester, rest in peace, the Corner House, one of the greatest cinemas ever. Just cried the whole thing. And Senna has a very special place in my heart anyway for other reasons. Like, he's my granddad's favourite driver. Me and my granddad used to watch the F1 together all those times.
Yeah. Nice one.
But there's something about these kind of documentaries that just really gets me.
Mm.
And I think it might have something to do with the current time we're in as well, and the removal of like collective joy.
Mm.
It adds extra weight to it, I think. And I don't know if that sounds a little bit melodramatic or over the top,
but
I think like seeing a load of human beings in tears in a joyful way, celebrating together in just like almost like carnage at a moment of collective joy that means it's about, I think, you know, when you're seeing, I think the thing is, it's like, you know, when you see it as well, I think, like, because I wasn't alive in 1970 and
it was my first real major footballing thing for me, because it was in colour,
and I can't remember, I was too young for 86. Anfield 89 was my first footballing memory,
not a bad one.
And then the first World Cup I can kind of remember being on was Italy 90. But I think there's, you know, when you watch moments in real time and you're like, I've just seen something historic. You know,
that was that was for me probably Maradona 86. That felt like that to me. You know, you're seeing something that's of real major significance.
And you can kind of feel like the earth shift off its axis a little bit.
Something happens.
I mean? Like, yeah.
Something happens.
Like, Moose always quotes the Captain Marvel thing, like something, or the Avengers thing where Captain Marvel pops up and it's like something has entered the upper earth atmosphere. And it's just like, yeah, something's changed. Like you can literally, yeah, it's almost like someone Bowie died or Prince died. It's like there are moments in life, like when Maradona died, like when all of our heroes die, it's the same thing with joy, you know, and like happiness. It's like, whoa, something's just happened that is seismic. And you can see how seismic so much of that was. But the thing that got me the most, I think, was seeing all the old Santos boys around the table eating together. There is something about sporting greats sitting together and shooting the shit about old times that will just never not be fascinating great. For me.
I, you know, when I watched it, right, because obviously Pelé for a long time, Cruyff came along and I was besotted with everything about Johan Cruyff. And I remember being able to, I got invited to UA for a golf day. I sat with Cruyff for 3 hours, bro. On the table. I've got the picture somewhere on my phone. My name, Ian Wright, Johan Cruyff on the same table, on those little cards. So he was massive for me. But like watching Pelé, I always wanted to be, and we're talking about generational, massive turn of generational talent. Same with Cruyff, same with Maradona, same with Messi, same with Ronaldo. You could go on, the Brazilian Ronaldo. But I didn't realize for one instant, when you're that good, when you're that great, when the whole country is depending on you, when you are a symbol of the country as just a normal kid who's grown up and is an exceptional footballer, the pressure that comes with that.
Mm.
All the time I used to dream of being a footballer and wanting to, and obviously wanting to emulate them, emulate those players, what they do. But the journey that those players have, especially you look at someone like Pelé and everything what was going on with the dictatorship and everything what was going on with the Brazilian national team and all that, you just think that, oh, he's just playing football. He must be having a great life. It must be the pressure that he was under for literally from the age of 17, Ryan, 2 goals in the World Cup final till the time he finished was just immense. It was fucking ridiculous. And you saw people talk about Pelé not speaking out about certain things, what was happening in Brazil with the dictatorship and everything, and talking about Muhammad Ali and how Muhammad Ali stood up and, you know, he's made a stand, and people saying, well, Pelé didn't do that. But what they say in the documentary, and I'm not going to give too much away, but it's vitally important that people know that Pelé's life under that dictatorship was under threat. If he comes out and goes and does anything or says anything against that dictatorship, he could go missing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, that's the one kind of like blot on his legacy that I think a lot of people in Brazil bring up. The thing is with stuff like that, I'm a white kid born in England, grew up in England and lives in Germany, 2 Western democracies. My honest opinion is, I don't know what a black superstar living in a military dictatorship in the 60s should have done.
Exactly.
That's my honest answer. That's my honest answer because I've never lived in a military dictatorship. I do not know what it's like. In an ideal world, you would have loved Pelé to take a stance on that for Brazilians. However, like in the documentary, it says, you know, Muhammad Ali was doing it in a democracy, which doesn't mean that the work he was doing isn't significant. It really was. I think that again, with stuff like this, like Musa wrote a really great piece about Pelé for The Ringer recently, based around the documentary. And the only caveat that a couple of the Brazilians were coming back with was the stuff around it. It was a little bit too neutral. However, it's like I said before, I mean, I think I'm just very wary of being like, well, this is what you should have done here.
Yeah, I know.
Like I've never seen my friends being dragged off and never been seen again. If we were going to be in a massive idol world, I think it would have been great to see him.
To see him stand up
and stuff like that. However, I wasn't there. I don't know. I'm not.
You know, we all would like to think that you would do the right thing in the right in the situation, because it's only the few special ones that stand up and put their life on the line for something that is wrong. Now, you look at Muhammad Ali. He done it. Cost him the best part of his career, but. Unless you know, God forbid, like people were going to assassinate him. Muhammad Ali wasn't going to disappear in the night or something. And as much as you could say that Pele should have done this and should have, it's very easy to say that.
Yeah.
Like I mean, a dictatorship in the 60s and...
It's never that cut and dried.
It can't be that cut and dry. And I would like, you know, it's very easy for somebody who's not in Pele's position to say that.
Yeah, I think I think you could tell in the documentary that was the one thing that he probably...
would have changed.
He manages his words very well in the documentary, I think. But I think in that scenario, you could tell that he probably wishes... But obviously time and hindsight is a wonderful thing. And I think the great thing about it was that I think that that 1970 win, that was Pele's World Cup. That was Pele's win. It wasn't a dictatorship. It wasn't the dictator's win. It wasn't the general's win. It was Pele's win.
Yeah.
And the other mind-blowing thing about that World Cup is just like, or that documentary, it's just the names. Just the names they've got. There's like, oh, there's Jairzinho. Oh, there's Rivellino.
Yeah.
Oh, there's Zagallo. All of these dudes, they just sat there. And then all of a sudden, fucking Gilberto Gil pops up. Are you kidding me?
Like, surely,
the most legendary Brazilian musicians of all time. It's a great documentary, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's a little bit of a, it's like very, very pro Pelé. But rightly so. I think that some of the stuff he did, I think Musa articulated it a hell of a lot better than I would in his piece. As a younger football fan who didn't watch him play live, it made me step back a little bit.
Yeah.
And in terms of the overall, like, all-time arguments.
To get to the level that he got to at 17, playing in the World Cup, scoring 2 goals, and then from the age of 17 to now, you know, we're talking about constant, intense pressure. We are watching a life that not many people can navigate and still be there now. That must be hard in these moments because we've seen everybody, the mask slips. And I'm not sure, when you look at Pelé, you cannot look at him as a person who's represented football and think of nothing other than ultimate professional.
Lovely place to finish.
Wow, right. That's beautiful, man.
Check it out of here. You've got to head to the motherland, haven't you?
AKA
the greatest city on earth.
Yeah, I've got to go to what, Manchester?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got to go to Manchester and do some, I've got to lay down some shit. Listen, man, I'm going to God's country, so.
Say hi to my people.
Yeah, man, your peeps. I let them know that you saw you in the house.
I miss it.
Right, thanks, man. Right, I feel better.
Good.
I feel better. Thanks for coming, my man.
Thanks for having me.
God bless. Thank you very much, guys, for listening on Righty's House. You know, it's always a pleasure to speak to you guys. I'm getting so much love. I love it. All I can say now, my friends, is stay safe, stay positive, and we'll speak again soon. God bless.
Are you talking to me?
I don't see nobody else here.
I don't see nobody else here.